again from the story catcher and her long-suffering editor, Amy Moss. As you know by now, in fact, I do rather go on about it, I live at the foot of the Magaliesberg Mountains. My camp is just about the last post before the land rises abruptly and forms a chain of rounded buttresses that are as iconic as they are beautiful. At night, I don't see a single electric light to the north of me, only the stars and the moon and Elon Musk's satellites. Hominids and humans have stared out at this very same night sky for hundreds of thousands of years, minus Elon's space pollution until very recently, of course. What is it that has made these mountains and valleys such an attractive place to settle? So many migrants have wandered down and across Africa and kept on going until they reached the Magaliesberg. Why did they stop here? Why do so many of us cease our wanderings here to this day? To answer these questions, I'm pleased to welcome again to Storycatcher, author, environmentalist, historian and born storyteller, Vincent Carruthers.
About 2,000 years ago or more, the population of Africa began to expand. People lived longer, the climate was right, and so as the population in Central Africa expanded, each family took on new grazing grounds for their cattle, and families needed new homes and so on. So the migration from Central Africa towards the south and east of Africa was not they were not refugees running away from a catastrophe or anything. They were just a population expanding and taking up more of the African continent. And eventually that movement or that expansion of people reached what is now about Zimbabwe. They got there probably about AD 100. They crossed over the Limpopo River in about 280 AD. In about 350 AD, one branch of them reached the Magaliesberg. And there, the migration stopped for some reason. For the next 300 or 400 years, there was no further movement south. There was some movement south down the east coast into Mozambique and into KwaZulu-Natal. But it's interesting that both of these two limbs of that migration stayed in savannah, in bushveld, because that's bushveld down in Natal. None of them ventured onto the grassland. So one assumes there was something about grassland which resisted their going there. The population, I'm sure, did expand, unless there was some catastrophe about which we don't know. But we don't know anything to suggest that. So it was expanding, but it was expanding east and west, not going south of the Magaliesberg. Now, there are other reasons why they would have stopped there. The one is that it is a marvelous place to live. There's an abundance of water because they're getting water from the Dolomite Caves, which is why one must never think of the Magaliesberg as a single ridge. It is a series of ridges, which quite correctly the earlier settlers used to call the Bunkenveld, because the bunker is a bench, and this was a series of benches, ridges going south. So always think of the Magaliesberg as a series of ridges, not just one mountain range. So further south than the Magaliesberg itself are the Dolomites, which are part of the ridges, sending oceans of water down the Crocodile River, so they had plenty of water. There is a very benign climate. The mountains protect one. I don't know if they do protect you enough in your tent, but it is a very benign, comfortable place to live.
Think about that tonight.
And then there was iron ore there, and these people were iron smelters and forgers of iron instruments. So that would have been an attraction to stop there. And in fact, there's plenty of evidence that they were mining iron. And incidentally, ochre, which is a form of iron ore, red ochre, which they would also use for decorating themselves and decorating the pots that they made. And they brought with them skills that gave them an advantage over the local hunter-gatherer communities. Those skills were, first of all, the ability to make iron weapons and tools. And always, you know, people immediately jumped to the conclusion that they were making spears to stab each other. That was probably a minor thing. The more important thing for living was a hoe, which could till the ground, and they planted, crops. They didn't have mealies. Mealies had not, maize had not reached Africa at the time that they were here. This is 350 AD. The Brits were running around with blue woad all over them and being governed by the Roman Empire. So we're talking about a long, long time ago.
Yeah, so you put it in context like yes. that, and it's a very different picture.
It is, and this so this is not in any way related to what we know of modern people. This was
and this is way prior to Great Zimbabwe or any of those grand settlements, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, Mapungubwe. Now those Zimbabwe and Mapungubwe are all what we now refer to as the late Iron Age. This period is the early Iron Age. And as I said, in southern Africa, it's right at the beginning of our millennium, 350 years into the Christian era. So it is a long, long time ago. Now, interestingly, at the place where they settled, there are also hunter-gatherer tools, or what we assume were hunter-gatherer tools. But there's now, very recently, quite interesting work has been done suggesting that actually some of those, what we might call Stone Age tools, were made by the Iron Age people. Uh-huh. They might have learned, well, they would have learnt them from the hunter-gatherers around them. Maybe they integrated with them, not necessarily into breeding with them, but living comfortably with them. Or they might have made them into servants. We don't know. But certainly things like stone scrapers, which are actually more efficient at scraping a hide off an animal and turning it into leather, it's actually a better instrument to have a sharp-edged stone to do that with than any iron thing which would cut the leather that you're trying to preserve. So there are lots of applications. Bone tools were another thing. It's much easier to make a bone arrowhead than it is to make an iron arrowhead. Iron took a lot of labor. You had to gather wood, turn it into charcoal, burn it, blow it with bellows into the high enough temperature, smelt it down, forge it into whatever shape you're looking for. So that's a hell of a lot of hard work. Mm. Whereas a bone tool, you scratch into the shape that you want and you've got an arrow or even a spear, perhaps. So that thinking is now going into the archaeological thought that maybe this was not two different cultures, but one culture using two different skills. This whole question of Stone Age and Iron Age, and it's archaeologists who have given us these labels. And of course, the labels are based on what has been found. The artifacts are what has survived. So iron tools and iron furnaces survive better than, say, grain or leather. And so they get these names, but actually, it's pretty sure that they didn't think of themselves as an Iron Age. They would have thought of themselves probably as a cattle age. But the other interesting thing is, did they have cattle? And that is hotly disputed. And when I say hotly, you know, academics get very hot under the collar about something they're not too sure about. And Professor Tom Huffman, who was a really brilliant archaeologist, says that they did have cattle, but he's basing it on very, very thin evidence. And if they did, there was very much less of it. There was almost certainly not a cattle economy, which is what the late Iron Age was based on. Even modern people keep cattle as a form of wealth today. In the late Iron Age, which is the sort of 19th and 18th centuries, cattle was the sole currency. That's what your wealth was based on. But not so these people. They had lots of goats. And there's lots of evidence of goat's bones in their middens that have been extracted. They had some religious cultures. They buried their dead. Certainly the dead important people were buried for a while until their bodies had disintegrated. And then they took out the skulls and a couple of limb bones and put them in a pot, which was then preserved in the village. So there was some ceremony to their burials, which that practice didn't follow through into the late Iron Age. So this was a different culture. We don't know whether they just continued living there and eventually became the later Iron Age people that we're more familiar with, or whether there was something that ended their era in about 600 or 700 AD and new people came in. We do know that another wave of Iron Age people did come from the West through the Botswana people. And that's well recorded in late Iron Age culture and oral traditions, that their ancestors came from the West. So the suggestion is, and it's no more than a guess, that these people either died out or were assimilated into another culture. Now, let's fast forward from 350 AD right through to the middle of the 20th century, or the beginning of the 20th century, 100 years ago, 1923. And two things happened that are significant. One is Hartebeespoort Dam was built, and it flooded some of the farms in the area. They were expropriated by the government, but obviously the ones that were expropriated, there was always a little bit of land that wasn't flooded. And the top part of a farm called Gert Cox Farm was not flooded, and that's coincidentally where this Iron Age settlement is that we know about. In the 1923 period, another thing happened, and that was that Robert Innes, who was the director of the Union Observatory in Johannesburg, it turned into the Republic Observatory eventually, but at the time it was the Union Observatory, he was given an honorary doctorate from Leiden University because of the services that he had done to astronomy, done for astronomy. when he went over to Leiden to discuss this with the Leiden people, they formed a collaboration which allowed Leiden astronomers to come to South Africa and use the telescopes here, and South Africans could go to Leiden to use their telescopes. The Leiden guys really liked to come here because they could view the southern sky from Johannesburg, which was at that time, 1923, a very good observation place. Later, light pollution destroyed that ability, so they moved their telescopes to the same place, but they didn't realize it, as where the Iron Age settlement was. Now, that was purely coincidental, but not quite as strange as you might think. The reason they went there was this was a bit of government-owned land that had no other purpose. It was just the bit of land that hadn't been flooded by the Hartebeespoort Dam. So it was a convenient place to donate it to the Leiden astronomers and let them put up what they called their southern station there, where they had three telescopes. And they worked on those telescopes from 1953, which is when they moved there. And then in 1972 or 3, one of their astronomers, they of course had an exchange of astronomers coming repeatedly, but one of them came out, Arno von Gendring, came out in 1973. So they've been there 20 years. And Arno von Gendring, by sheer coincidence, was also an archaeologist. And he, when he wasn't looking up, as he told me in one of his emails, when I wasn't looking up, I was looking down. And he noticed all these pot shards and ostrich eggshell beads and bits and pieces lying around. And he realized that this was obviously an archaeological site, which had never been mentioned before. He went off with a bag of artifacts that he'd picked up outside his cottage. He went to Wits University to see Revel Mason, who was the archaeologist who was specializing in the Magaliesberg region. Mason said, "This is incredible." He recognized immediately that these were not late Iron Age pot shards and things that were being brought to him. These, as he put it, were 1,000 years older than anything that he had found so far. He had found one or two elsewhere up in the northern parts of South Africa, but nothing around here. And he realized that he'd been brought an example of something quite extraordinary. He then went out to the site and verified this, and he worked on the site for 2 years. Van Genderink and his wife and his little daughter lived there for 8 years, observing, and that's what he was paid to do, observing the sky, but at the same time helping Revel Mason and his team to excavate the site. And so we have this wonderful 20th century science, because the telescopes were very state-of-the-art stuff, and a 1,700-year-old civilization or culture on the ground around. And that had a lot of importance. Remember, the 1970s was at the height of apartheid. One of the pillars of apartheid was the theory that because we knew about the late Iron Age, that it was about the same time as whites were arriving in the Cape, Van Riebeck and people were arriving in the Cape. So we all have a shared ancestry that sort of we all arrived in South Africa about the same time. Well, this shattered that particular pillar by saying, no, actually blacks were here at least 1,000 years before then. So that it had historical significance, political significance. It got a lot of press attention, but more in Holland than here. And the Netherlands people, because it was their astronomers who'd made the discovery, made quite something of this discovery. And it's a wonderful treasure. And one of the good news things about it is that that land has now, through a whole lot of circumstances, ended up as belonging to the Tshwane University of Technology. So it is not going to be turned into a holiday resort or anything, although it is on the Hartebeespoort Dam. And the university has now taken ownership of the treasure that they own. I mean, they owned it anyway, but now they've realized the incredible asset that this is, academically, historically, and everything else. And as a heritage site, it's fantastic.
Fantastic, it certainly is. Just fantastic. You know, that the universal magic of stargazing should be experienced by people with stone and iron tools at the very same spot as people who stargaze with high-powered, sophisticated machinery. Fantastic. Now, not too far from the Hartebeespoort Observatory is the village of Sonop. It's a kind of living memorial to the social engineering and job preservation that the apartheid regime was renowned for. But it's also a testament to the drive and opportunism that caused the regime to flourish for many decades, even in the face of international condemnation and boycotts.
The story of Sonop is actually the story of Hartebeespoort Dam, because when Hartebeespoort Dam was built, it was built primarily as a poverty relief scheme. And it was to relieve the post-Anglo-Boer War poverty that had arisen amongst rural Afrikaans-speaking people and give them employment in building the dam, secondly, employment in building the canal system, and then give them the opportunity to own land themselves by earning it from labor on the land itself. And so we had two schemes going under the PACT government, which was a combination of the National Party and the Labour Party that came together in a pact to defeat the Smuts government in 1924. There are two canals that leave the dam, and one was supervised and organized by the Labour Party, and the other was supervised by the National Party. The National Party one was, the system was that you were given a plot of, I think, about 10 Morgan, which is more or less 10 hectares, I suppose, and you were told exactly how to farm it, how to behave, right down to how your children cleaned their teeth and what sort of a diet you have. It was an amazing imposition of social structure on them, and they had to obey that because the whole purpose was to elevate these people out of poverty to become good white citizens. And that meant that they had to live hygienically. Their daughters were not allowed to wear short skirts, anything like that. But they were also told exactly how to farm the land. And provided they did obey those rules, the produce that they produced was sold for them on the market by the government, and they would earn a proportion of the income that that generated. And gradually, over a period of probably a decade, they would be able to afford to actually buy the plot of land that they were working on. And that would become theirs. And some of them actually did. They managed to survive that long period of tenure. The other canal, which was run by the Labour government, which was really based on English farming practice, which is not suitable at all for Bushveld, South Africa, was that the people lived in a village. And then they went out from the village and worked on the land each day and came back. And they also earned a living, and they would also be eligible, but it was a much stiffer process of eligibility that they had to go through. But one of the villages they lived in was Sonop. Another one was Losberfontein, which takes its name from the farm, Losberfontein, on which they were. And these were all properties in the canal areas, all beautifully irrigated farms with irrigation infrastructure, which is still viable and works very well indeed today. It was land that, from which the Bakatla and the Bakwena people had been evicted in the 1920s to make way for this white settlement. The conditions under which they were settled were rigid. They, apart from their behavior, they were not allowed any black servants at all. There was no black labor available to them. and they had to work themselves on the land, and their children had to work that way, although the children were given schooling as well. So it worked to an extent, but there was an enormous amount of pressure to actually have black labour, and I think a lot of it probably leaked into these farms. But if you were caught with a servant on your land, you were expelled. And they did pitch people off their land if they failed to comply with this system. But Sonop has still got a very good school, and it is the same one that was built in the 1920s for the children of the labourers, the people who were moving on. It has a very good hospital, which started off as a clinic for the local area. So it provided services for the region that were really very acceptable, and it made the region quite livable in. And, of course, the land is fantastic because it is all irrigated farmland with canals running everywhere. Everybody had a little dam of his own with a sluice gate that he could open and close and utilize. And the farming techniques were prescribed and enforced, but it meant that you learned how to farm properly. And you weren't learning the sort of bad habits, perhaps, that of your father who'd learned it from his father. So this was a new way of farming and made the whole region very prosperous. And a drive along the canals is actually a very enlightening little history lesson through Sonop and Losperfontein, and see how an enormous breadbasket that land is now that is watered from the Hartebeespoort Dam. And the canals themselves are a marvel of engineering, and they took both longer to make and more cost than the dam wall itself.
What?
Yes, they are an enormous investment, and they took a long time. I don't think they were completed until about 1927 or 8 before the whole canal system was in place, because they are gravity fed from the dam all the way along. Both of them are about 50 kilometers, and there are no locks or interference with their flow. They just flow at a dead even pace for 50 kilometers. So the engineering to keep that level is incredibly precise, and it's actually an engineering wonder. But that is what makes the land so valuable, because you can take off little sub canals, feed them into dams, and do all sorts of irrigation mechanics with this water, and make extensive use of it all the way. And it's a constant feed, come drought or flood, from Hartebeespoort Dam at a constant rate. So it was a great feat. And it's just 100 years old. The dam was finished in 1923, and the dams were finished during the course of the 1920s. So we're at its centenary at the moment.
Vincent Carruthers with another of his fascinating stories about the Magaliesberg and its environs. And I'm pleased to tell you that he'll be back sometime in the future with yet more tales from South Africa's richest of rich heritage and history. And I'll have another of South Africa's stories in a couple of weeks' time. I hope it's one of yours. Goodbye till then.